I'm glad to be with you again. I came here to give a talk just about a year ago and really enjoyed our evening together. So glad for the invitation from Gil to come and talk again. I'm grateful to call Gil a friend and someone with whom I have talked. The great Zen teacher Shunryu Suzuki Roshi once said that to give a Dharma talk is to make a mistake on purpose. And I think he meant in part that hearing a talk like this can do a little bit of help for us, but ultimately our freedom comes from actually practicing the Dharma. But I also feel that in a way it's always a mistake when someone tries to share the purity of the Dharma through a personality that's unfinished. So whatever mistakes I make, this is basically an unfinished project here. Whatever mistakes I make tonight, I apologize for ahead of time. I'd like to talk this evening about a subject that has become in recent years compellingly important for me, and it may have some application at least to some people here. And I'd like to start actually with a fairly grim passage from a great work of literature. You may know Leo Tolstoy's novella, The Death of Ivan Illich. Ivan Illich is dying of cancer, and he comes to a late discovery, very close to his death, to a late discovery about his life. So I'd like to read a passage from this novella. It occurred to him that what had appeared perfectly impossible before, namely, that he had not spent his life as he should have done, might after all be true. It occurred to him that his scarcely perceptible attempts to struggle against what was considered good by the most highly placed people, those scarcely noticeable impulses which he had immediately suppressed, might have been the real thing, and all the rest false. And his professional duties and the whole arrangement of his life and of his family, and all his social and official interests might all have been false. He tried to defend all those things to himself and suddenly felt the weakness of what he was defending. There was nothing to defend. But if that is so, he said to himself, and I am leaving this life with the consciousness that I have lost all that was given to me, and it is impossible to rectify it, what then? He lay on his back and began to pass his life in review in quite a new way. In the morning, when he saw first his footman, then his wife, then his daughter, and then the doctor, their every word and movement confirmed to him the awful truth that had been revealed to him during the night. In them he saw himself, all that for which he had lived, and saw clearly that it was not real at all, but a terrible and huge deception which had hidden both life and death. This consciousness intensified his physical suffering tenfold. He groaned and tossed about and pulled at his clothing, which choked and stifled him, and he hated them on that account. Pretty grim. But actually, the Buddha said that one of the forms of suffering, one of the exquisite forms of suffering that we can experience, actually, is to come to the end of our life and to look back and feel that we had not lived our life well, that we had not used our life well. It's a fate that I really hope none of us will have. But I'd like to talk this evening about one aspect of our lives that actually can prevent us from making the right choices. The choice, for example, to make an effort with our spiritual practice and to come to deeper levels of liberation and freedom. And for me, what has triggered this reflection over the last few years of my life is actually one of the phrases from loving kindness practice. I'm sure that many people here are familiar with metta or the loving kindness practice in this Theravada or Vipassana tradition. And the four phrases of metta that I was taught by my teacher, very traditional kinds of phrases, and there are many variations on these phrases. But the first, if you're extending loving kindness, a sense of friendship or connection toward yourself, is to make the wish, may I be happy. The second is to make the wish for yourself, may I be safe from inner and outer harm. The third is, may I be healthy in body and mind. And the fourth is, may I live with ease. Sharon Salzberg translates that fourth phrase as, may I live with ease of well-being. And it struck me a few years ago that I wasn't living with ease. And it seems like it might be actually quite important if it's included in these wishes of loving kindness practice. It's not easy to live with ease in our particular society. Do you have a sense that you have lived with ease today, this Monday, November 20th, 2000? Or do you have a sense that you might live with ease tomorrow? For me, it's a struggle, actually. And as I've come to reflect more and more on that very simple phrase, may I live with ease, it feels to me, there have been times for me as if it's a thirsty person contemplating water. You know, it's very important. It has felt very important to me. And it's very important, I think, in terms of our spiritual practice. I'd like to read a passage from the Buddha. Without giving up six things, O followers, it will not be possible to dwell practicing mindfulness of the body as the body. He's going through the four foundations of mindfulness, which is the center of our practice. To practice mindfulness as feelings, to practice mindfulness of the mind as the mind, to practice the objects, mindfulness of the objects of mind as the objects of mind. Which are these six that prevent us from actually pursuing our spiritual practice? To be fond of activity, to be fond of talking, to be fond of sleeping, to be fond of company, to lack control of the senses, to be immoderate in eating. So I just want to focus on the first of these six obstructions to our practice, to be fond of activity. I feel that we live actually in the most hyperactive and overstimulated culture in the history of the world right now. It's very hard to avoid overactivity in our lives. Maybe this doesn't apply to you. It has certainly applied to me in my life. And it's really interesting to this is one expression that I love by a friend of mine, Diana Winston. Earlier this year, the Buddhist Peace Fellowship brought out its newsletter, Turning Wheel, was about time and the use of time. And Diana Winston wrote an article called Speed. And I'd like to just read a passage from this, and perhaps you can relate to it. I don't have time to write letters, read books, visit my friends, play with my little brother, kiss, touch, sigh, dance, relate, eat ice cream, make music, pray, smell, meditate, take a walk, my God, make it all stop. I don't have time and it's running out, and I'm running fast and furiously and I want it to stop, ouch, it's painful. Why won't it stop? Can't you make it stop? My God, what's wrong with this country? Have we all gone crazy? Are we insane? We've lost touch, we've lost touch, we've got to stop this endless running about. All I want to do is slow down. This is all one sentence, no punctuation. All I want to do is slow down, just crawl into bed and rock myself to sleep. Not this craziness, not this crazy running about. I am so tired. Please, somebody, you have got to help me stop. I think it's hard, you know, and it's always the reality within us, in our own psyches, in our own hearts and minds, connects to and reflects the external reality in which we live. So it's been useful for me to really look in this heart and mind and see, why do I keep too much overactivity in my life that prevents me from making the right choices in terms of what is really important to me? And it feels important because I would like to come to the end of my life and look and reflect back and say, oh yes, I used this life well. I held the priorities in my mind. I made the right choices. I don't feel it's so easy to do that in this culture. And I find at times that I allow this mind to be distracted by all kinds of activities and connections and interactions and media. I allow it to be distracted because there's a way in which there's a kind of a fear of silence, a fear of stillness, a fear of what might come up in the silence and stillness, a fear of the kind of pain that might be covered up by all the activity. You know, beneath the restlessness can be feelings of fear or anxiety or despair or desire that are really unpleasant and difficult. The internal reality, and then there's the external reality, all of the enormous forces that affect us in our lives. We live in a culture of great materialism and consumption. And so for many of us, we feel obliged to work very hard to make more money, to get more material things to use in our diminished leisure time. And for many of us, I don't know if it's so true here in the Palo Alto area. It's certainly true in New Mexico, where I live, which is a very poor state, that many people in our society, in our culture, are actually forced to work more. That in the 1950s, for example, it was fairly common for one person to be a wage earner in a family and to support a whole family that way. It's very, very rare now for that to happen. So people are actually, with the growing difference in wealth in our society, many people have to work more jobs, they have to work more time. They have less time. You know, there was a tremendous effort had to be made, enormous effort over decades to give us the 40-hour week, which is now just disappearing. The average is now 52 hours, actually, for people to work, and it's not unusual for people to work 60 or 70 hours a week. I don't know, for those of us who have gray hair, do you remember 30 or 35 years ago when the sociologists were all so terribly worried about how automation would create so much leisure time we wouldn't know what to do with ourselves? And they were sort of debating, what are we going to get people to do when they have so much leisure time? Whatever happened to that? We also live in a in an age of enormous, massive amounts of information coming into our lives, much more than in the past, it's hard to hold a clear sense of direction in the midst of all that information. A psychologist in Los Angeles, Rex Julian Bieber, said, "The mind's hunger for information is like the body's drive for food. The brain is a junkie for sensory stimulation. Consciousness abhors a vacuum." When we have more information and less time, and hence less reflective knowledge, there isn't very much room for wisdom in our lives. So it's interesting to see the influences of a world which is moving faster and faster. Again, for those of us who are older, you may remember Toffler's book, Future Shock. You know that the world is going to speed up and there's going to be more and more change. Clearly, future shock is here now. And we, someone also was writing about the boomer generation and saying we boomers invented the remote control for television sets, and we invented attention deficit culture. You know, with that sense of speed, then the sense of actually staying focused on things is more difficult. It's literally true. I read a newspaper a while back. It's literally true that the television networks are getting concerned about that little space between the end of a television program and the commercial. It's less than a second, but they think it causes anxiety for the viewers. Really, they're trying to find ways to eliminate that space. You know, I could go on and on about this subject, but it's really our external reality has really changed over recent decades, and it affects our lives. It makes living with ease more difficult. And so it takes more of a real clear and conscious decision. And I'd like to just suggest briefly, because I'd love to have a discussion about this, if you're interested, to maybe suggest ways in which the Dharma can be helpful to us in terms of making clear choices around this whole subject of too much activity, too much, too much, too much. There's one way, sort of the deeper way, in the midst of all this change in activity. The Buddha said that there is a reality which is changeless. The Buddha described nirvana, or in Pali, nibbana. He said profound, peaceful, free from all troubles, luminous and uncreated, like an elixir of immortality. And in another passage, the Buddha said, "Bliss, yes, bliss, my friends, is nirvana. That which is unchanging." And then Edward Conci says that nirvana is permanent, stable, imperishable, immovable, ageless, deathless, unborn and unbecome. That it is power, bliss and happiness, the secure refuge, the shelter, and the place of unassailable safety. That it is the real truth and supreme reality, that it is the good and the supreme goal and the one and only consummation of our life, the eternal, hidden, and incomprehensible peace. If we have any sense of that unassailable safety and of a reality which is our deepest reality, which is of that which is unchanging, it gives us a very stable place from which to view the immense changes in our world, the coming and going, the overstimulation. So I think the Buddha's teachings hold out that perspective. And then on a more practical level, I think it can be really useful for us to actually make choices in our lives. And this is something that I have been doing for myself. I've really made this a practice in recent years. Is actually to say, and to be very conscious, and to say about every single activity and every single relationship in my life, to say, does this really serve my liberation? Is this really important? And perhaps it is. You know that many of us are in circumstances where it is important. You know, if you happen to have a job some kind of intimate relationship, and to be raising children, and to be involved in a spiritual group, and you know, you may be juggling a great many things in your life where you say, this is absolutely important, I make this choice, and I will stay busy for this phase of my life, and that's perfectly fine. But I have found in my own life that there's a way in which I sort of make unconscious choices. And very often, you know, when we're living in a world where there is so much stress in our lives, very often what we do is to find ways to self-medicate simply to relieve the suffering of the stress. And so it's possible to turn to alcohol or to drugs or to sexual addiction or to television or to whatever it is that we need in order to relieve our pain from being stressed out. It's a bit like the theory in macrobiotics. They say that if you eat red meat, which is very yang, then you're going to have to eat sugar, which is very yin. And their suggestion is let go of the red meat, let go of the sugar, and find a more balanced way in the middle. If we are living highly stressed lives, then we have to balance that out often with behaviors or habits that aren't so good for us. I was talking to a friend just 2 days ago on Saturday who was saying, I get home, I'm so tired, the only thing I can do is to lie on the couch and turn on the television. And she says, I have to do that, you know, as an antidote to a life that is too stressed out. So for me, it's been very useful to say, is it useful for me to reduce the stress? Is it useful for me to make choices about the activities of my life? Is it useful for me to simplify? Is it useful for me to practice some form of renunciation that actually is nurturing for me rather than a deprivation? And I have found it has been, actually.
Could you say that again? Yeah,
it's just that for me to make the choices of letting things go from my life, that once I bring the clarity of mindfulness and awareness really to catalog the activities of my life, the relationships of my life, to say, is this really serving? And to be able to let many of those things go in a way that doesn't feel like a deprivation, it actually feels like a gift and a nurturing to myself. So I find myself living a simpler life with more happiness because I've chosen to let go of many things in my life, to really simplify. It has been useful to me, and I find that for myself at least, then there's space. There's more space for me to do that which is really wholesome, like to have a regular yoga practice and to find space to do meditation practice every day, to get the exercise that this body needs, and the exercise tends to fall away if I get too stressed, to maintain a certain level of emotional and mental health by reducing the stresses in my life. Nobody can make these decisions for us. Each one of us has to make the decision ourselves. But it feels to me important, actually. If it feels important, actually, to take that phrase seriously, may I live with ease. I don't know, it just sounds so good to me. So if it feels appropriate, I mean, there's much more I could say on this subject, but if it feels appropriate, if you don't mind, I'd just like to do a very brief guided loving kindness meditation, directing that loving kindness toward ourselves. And feel free to get plenty comfortable. This practice is actually about enjoying yourself. So be as comfortable as you want to be. And then if you would, just bring your attention inward to your body sitting right now. And if you would, bring your awareness to the heart energy center in the middle of your chest, just behind the sternum or the breastbone. Just feeling whatever is there in this moment. And then if it feels appropriate, just to send your breath through the heart center, breathing through the heart center, as it were. This practice opens the heart. And then directing a sense of benevolence and connection and kindness and friendship toward yourself, just to extend the wish silently, breathing through the heart, may I be happy. May I be safe from inner and outer harm. May I be healthy in body and mind. May I live with ease. And then just to go back over the same ground in a slightly different way, is to have that wish, may I be happy. And then is it possible to actually make the commitment, if being happy is important to you, to make the commitment to yourself, I will do what is necessary in order to bring myself happiness. And then to make the wish, may I be safe from inner and outer harm. And if being safe feels important enough to you, to make the commitment, and I will protect myself in wholesome ways. And then to make the wish, may I be healthy in body and mind. And if it feels appropriate, if having that kind of emotional or mental and physical health are important enough to you, to make the commitment, I will do all that I can to support my mental and physical health. And that means making choices. And then to make the wish, may I live with ease. And if living with ease seems important, to make the commitment to yourself, and I will do what is necessary in order to come to some ease in my life. I'll be easier on myself. Thank you. I'd like to end, if I can find it here, with a poem actually that may be very familiar to many of us. And if you know this poem intimately, please listen to it as if you're hearing it for the first time, because it's really apropos, wonderfully apropos of this subject. It's Mary Oliver's The Summer Day. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean. The one who has flung herself out of the grass. The one who is eating sugar out of my hand. Who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down. Who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? So thank you. Any comments or questions on the subject of living with ease? Please.
I'm just curious about, for example, someone stressed out goes home, watches TV. To them, that's trying to be at ease.
Right.
Realizing, you know, this is not something I want to do the way I want to go. I'm not going to turn TV on or do whatever I usually do. It can be a lot of stress at that time.
Right.
I guess like a withdrawal symptom almost. What's the wise way of, I guess, being compassionate with yourself to go through that rather than just try to, you know, cut it off?
Make a big project.
Yeah.
I would say go gently. But I, you know, it's my sense, it's not true for all of us, but my sense is that often we'll go home after a day of stress and turn on the TV in order to, as an antidote to the stress. A more fundamental way of working at it is to reduce the stress so that we don't have to seek out the antidote. I spent basically a decade doing a whole lot of meditation practice back in the 80s. And I would go off and do really long retreats, months and months. And I would come out and then re-engage in my life, you know, and take on the work and all of it, and get horribly stressed out. And then I'd go off into retreat again, and I'd go back into my life, and trying to adapt myself to this crazy life. And it took me a long time, a slow learner. You know, some people are some dogs are one episode learners. I'm not a one episode learner. It took me a long time. I came out of retreat and I said to myself, I can change my life. You know, instead of adapting to it, I can actually change it. And it's taken me a long time to do that. But I think it just maybe in terms of how to be compassionate with yourself, in terms of that process, is not to do it in any kind of abrupt and willful way, but really to be a reflective, you know, to really take stock of your life and say what is really serving me and what isn't, what is really necessary and what isn't, and then very gradually, you know, to let go of the relationships that may not be so wholesome, to let go of the activities that may not be so wholesome in a gradual kind of way. And see if it's working, you know. And you'll know if it's working if there's more of a sense of balance and ease in your life. Does this make sense? I mean, it's not—it's very general guidelines, but I think it's a good project.
Yeah. is what I wanted to hear.
Please.
I got to turn down my hearing aid.
Mm-hmm.
I have the perfect solution. I'm not stressed. I'm not all these things you were talking about.
Right.
Because I'm retired.
Uh-huh. Sounds good. Sounds good. You should be sitting in this chair.
No. Anyway, it's very helpful to be retired.
Sounds good. Thank you. Please. Yeah, it's actually I was the resident Vipassana resident teacher of Vipassana communities in Santa Fe and Albuquerque, and as I was basically the pastor of those communities, and I loved the work, but I also traveled to lead retreats around the country, and I found I couldn't do both, and I burned out, you know, I got too stressed, and. And so I've left that work, and I've actually moved to a really remote place in southwestern New Mexico, a very beautiful place called Silver City. And friends and I are just in the process of founding an intentional Dharma community where we will, where a number of Buddhist practitioners will live and practice together. And so far there are three of us. We don't have property yet, but we're underway, and we hope to grow to maybe 14 or 16 people, and it just feels like to me like just the right thing to do in my life. And I understand, you know, we don't have a great history of success of living in community in this country, but I feel like the Dharma actually has been a very powerful vehicle for intentional Dharma community for over 2,500 years in the monastic tradition. And it's just a question now of our translating, we feel, of translating into lay people living together and practicing together. So we're calling it a kind of lay monasticism. You know, we're basically intending to practice the Eightfold Path together. It's just in its nascent stages, but I have a kind of idiot optimism about it. You know, if we meet in 3 or 4 years, maybe I'll have a different perspective. Please.
Is your group called Kusinara?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm in touch with you.
Oh, great. Uh-huh. Wow, okay. Please.
Well, instead of reducing the activities, this way dealing with stress is... It seems like in Vipassana tradition they are also striving to just be more skillful in dealing with the activities.
Yes.
And not get caught up and identified.
Right. That's exactly true. It's exactly true. And I think you're right. The more that we're able to maintain mindfulness, the more that we have actually are able to develop the qualities of concentration, it's possible to bring a kind of stillness and balance into the midst of activities. But just about any mind has its limits. Please.
Yes, so I was going to point out, I mean, our culture is so constantly bombarded with stimulation that mind actually just filters stuff out. And you don't even see a lot of stuff because you couldn't process all of it. And you see that clearly when you go on a retreat and you spend the first day clearing all that stuff out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Please.
As I consider the brief moments when I have ease in my life in the midst of the Silicon Valley schedule, it is when the work is coming through me rather than myself doing it.
Right.
And the invitation to that has to be very conscious. It is never at any moment except that instant, rather than trying to plan ahead what I'm going to do or what I'm going to say. And that's the only way that I know how to even just briefly caress it. background, and it doesn't stay very long.
Eloquent. It's eloquently put, and it's if we are not identified with what is happening, it doesn't have the same impact. You know, my teacher Joseph Goldstein often describes it this way, and very graphically. He said, normally we relate to our experience like this, and he said, a liberated mind relates to experience like this. You know, and I think that's what you're describing is with that sense of without identification, then the work moves through you. And may you have many more moments like that. Please.
I had a question about, you talked about having all these things that you did and you're trying to do fewer of them. How do you deal with the requests? The people who come and say, well, we really need you to do this, so
right.
We want you to do that.
I mentioned that this is a work in progress, and you know, I'm probably many people who are drawn to serving others, as I do in my work, as a teacher of the Dharma, are codependent personalities. You know, where we don't have very good boundaries. I'm learning that. It's very difficult at times. You know, because people call me with very, very real needs. And if I'm able to, I'm learning that if I have the strength, I really want to be available to them. There are times when I'm learning to say, at this moment I can't help you. You know, I can help you tomorrow. It's hard. It's very hard. You know, and I find that as I grow older and I have more skills, there are actually more and more demands. So it's not as if the demands are diminishing over time, they're actually increasing. So you've put your finger on the biggest challenge for me, but I'm finding, I'm learning to be more balanced with it, and it's an enormous blessing in my life. You know, I would go into the communities that I was serving, absolutely stressed out, and give a Dharma talk. You know, and even if the words were right. Even if my intellectual understanding of the teaching that I was sharing was right, the energetic level, I was not giving them, and I wasn't modeling for them, you know, a life of balance and ease. And so it's been very useful for me to do much less. You know, I have pretty good energy tonight. You know, as I speak, so that the energy is not the energy of constriction and anxiety. So it's a really important question. We as individuals cannot be there for all beings all the time. You know, and to find a way, as the question here was, how do we be compassionate to ourselves? Is a very important one. That's a vast topic, but. Thank you for raising the issue, even. Yes, yeah, just, please.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Please, go ahead.
I took a big, huge cut and paid that $25,000 to actually do my work. I have to read the huge ancient novel. Actually, I'm doing hospice work right now, which is a wonderful, wonderful profession. And it puts me in touch with that the essence live, but I find that, you know, not having enough money, raising two kids, and all the stresses of dealing with what you're talking about, you know, just the pull of just so many people in need.
Right.
And the emotional kind of things, in the moment of my day, I can have a great meditation in the morning and one at night, but in the middle of that day, there is this, I wonder how one can come to that place of where there's this tension and be able to kind of let that go somehow, where there's this feeling of being pulled and hugged, and which causes a lot of stress
right.
in the middle of the day. And rather than trying to, you know, like what you were saying, let the work kind of go through you,
Yes, I do. I do, and I think my guess is that we could get many suggestions from this group. Just one small one is that I have a friend who's a meditation teacher who sets her watch to beep. And when it beeps on the hour, unless she's deeply engaged in something, she just stops and breathes for 15 seconds. You know, just stops for 15 seconds just to breathe. And she finds that that really helps her in terms of, you know, it's not, we can't sit for 45 minutes in the middle of working in a hospice, but it is possible to take a moment to stop, to come back to our bodies, to breathe, to find a kind of balance. And to let go of the tension. It's also really useful to watch what the intentions are that lead to our actions. You know, I find for myself the degree to which I'm responding to people's needs out of anxiety or not wanting to disappoint them or whatever causes a kind of stress. The degree to which I'm actually responding out of a place of compassion makes it really easy, that compassion is an enormously sustaining quality of consciousness. And for most of us, compassion and that kind of anxious, not wanting people to be disappointed or whatever, get mixed in together. To be able to distinguish between those two, strengthen one and reduce the other. You know, the Buddha says, cultivate what is wholesome, abandon what is unwholesome. The degree to which one is able to do that, it's possible more and more to have a kind of sustained, wholesome energy of intention in the midst of the demands of a day. Again, each one of these questions is something that we could really go into for hours. So, but thank you for raising it. Just a final thing, we're just about...
Well, I notice often that I seem to have an assumption that when the mind is alert, the body is also alert, i.e. tense. And... I'd like to try to disconnect those notions.
Right.
And just wondered if you could
comment. Yeah, just a real quick story. When my teachers went to Barre, Massachusetts, looking to start a center in the mid-70s, and they came to this former Catholic monastery. And it was this huge place, and they thought, could we ever fill it? It became Insight Meditation Society. They were really nervous. This was Sharon Salzberg and Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield and others. And they went into the little town of Barre, Massachusetts, to the town common, and they were trying to think, should we do this, shouldn't we? And they found this statue on the town common that had the motto for the town of Barre, Massachusetts, which was tranquil and alert. And they said, okay, we'll do it. That's it. It's really a quality of holding tranquility and alertness at the same time. So a tense body is not an alert body necessarily. It's just so just to remember the two qualities and to hold them in balance. So thank you very much. This has been fun.